Hello, I'm Dan Masterson, host of Strategy Talk, where we take a unique view of world events. We report news as history. With me today is the editor of StrategyPage.com and well-known military author, Jim Dunnigan. Associate editor and syndicated columnist, Austin Bay, also joins us.
Good morning, Jim and Austin. It's been a while since we've been on, and during that three-week period, Mr. Bin Laden seemed to have found some new friends that he quickly fell out with.
You're referring to U.S. Navy SEALs?
Navy SEALs, yes. I think one of the jokes that we posted online was the first words out of Osama's mouth was, I need six Navy SEALs in my house like I need a hole in the head. So, but anyhow, there's been a lot of talk about, you know, the killing and like that, and we know all about that. I thought what would be interesting to talk about today was what the aftermath is going to be, and is there going to be somebody that pops up in his place? But there's also been this weird, I think one of the things to talk about this morning is the questioning of how he was buried and the burial at sea, because that's caused a bunch of conspiracy theorists to pop up and like that. But the truth is, Austin, what else were they going to do with the body?
Are you asking me, Dan,
yeah,
on
mm-hmm.
this? Look, you've got so many different pressures here. One of the things, if you look at it from a diplomatic angle, you're showing respect to a dead man, even though he's a wanted mass murderer. You can see why whoever made that call, whether it was coming from DOD, CIA, or the White House, it's an understandable call to make in the crisis. You do have the cultural impetus that to bury the body within 24 hours, and then you move to some of the more realpolitik components, which is, do you want to have a burial site that he would be treated as a martyr? Where would you have it? There's also reports, and you know, I can only go here on what I read on Reuters or Agence France-Presse, that the United States asked Saudi Arabia and perhaps some other countries if they wanted a body, and no one wanted to touch it. What do you do with it? Now you've got the issue of icon, martyr, myth. At some point, if you accepted it too, you also are saying, well, we are in some ways, not necessarily aligned, but connected to Bin Laden. And I think a lot of countries said, we don't want that issue, political and diplomatic issue, we don't want to grapple with it. So you're left to, what do you do with it? Navy SEALs, as far as we can tell, are the ones who were responsible for the successful mission. Aircraft carrier out in the Indian Ocean, it's a good place to go ahead and bury him. It's a recognized place, burial at sea. You get rid of some of the realpolitik concerns. You meet to some degree Muslim burial right criteria, and the one thing that does, I've seen a couple of the conspiracy theories, is that why go to the extent of having a 30 or 40 minute burial ceremony when Bin Laden has been portrayed as a Muslim heretic, which, by the way, I believe he is a Muslim heretic. Why give him the rights? Again, that's one of those calls in the moment, and you can always come back and say he's dead, we got him, and we decided, you know, that at some level that we were going to go through with the ceremony, because in many ways, it was a civilized thing to do. You're going to get criticized either way you go with it. So I'm not too concerned about the conspiracy theories I've read, but if you've got a really good one, Dan, I'm all ears.
I don't. I mean, you know, I've looked at enough of the stuff that, and none of the conspiracy stuff makes any sense, especially with Al Qaeda coming out and recognizing that he was dead.
I'm essentially saying a decision that could go. You could have gone several ways with it. Every single one of them has a downside, somewhat upside, and a burial at sea looks like it has more upside than downside. I wonder what Jim thinks about that.
Yeah, I mean, you want to get rid of the body without leaving a potential shrine for, you know, Islamic terrorists. And that's one way to deal with it. I'm not surprised that, I suppose, Yemen and Saudi Arabia, I can't think of any other candidates, did not want to touch it because that's the last thing they wanted was a terrorist shrine, you know, on their soil. So, you know, dump them at sea. And there is no standard religious authority in Islam. So no matter what religious ceremony you use to bury him at sea, and that is allowed in the Islamic religion, you're going to irritate someone. So I agree with Austin on that. You know, no matter what you do, somebody's going to come out. And the media looks for that kind of stuff.
Well, look, and part of that,
so it's guaranteed.
You're dealing with some cultural traditions and not the explicit mandates on it. And the United States government essentially said, well, we're going to acknowledge those cultural traditions. And there's a diplomatic, potentially diplomatic upside to it. There's obviously downside as well. And I actually, Dan, I see this as one of those side issues, as Jim says, that certain types of the media want to write about. So, you know, but it's a side issue.
Right. Now, one of the questions, Jim, is what happens next? I know you wrote a fairly critical piece on what is going to be going on in Afghanistan. Also, there's the question of you had written something a little bit about al-Zawahiri and how he is not a people person. So is there going to be somebody that steps into the vacuum? Is there going to be another group that pops up? What's going to happen at this point?
Well, the only people who had a good idea of what's going to happen next are the people who are examining that treasure trove of documents they dragged out of, Chateau Bin Laden. And as I explained in another piece on the intelligence fallout, that is going to be critical. Hopefully they're not screwing it up. I mean, they should, we've reported a lot of this, you know, without giving away too many military secrets. The way the intelligence, system works with the data mining and the use of math and the sensor, information. The information they've gotten out of the Bin Laden documents, should fill in a lot of blanks that they've had over the years. For example, it's long been suspected that the Egyptian number two, al-Zawahiri, God, I hate those names, has not been as charismatic as Bin Laden. And apparently from what they have picked up and what has leaked out, as you say, he's not a people person, and there may be some pushing and shoving in determining who's going to be, you know, number two. But this is like saying who's going to be number two on the Titanic as it goes down. Al-Qaeda basically destroyed itself in Iraq by killing all those civilians. I mean, we reported that, you know, showed how, you know, Muslim countries in general that ran opinion surveys, you could see Al-Qaeda's approval ratings nosedive. And
that
in turn,
2005, by the way, guys, I'm going to bump that. 2005 and 2006, we were running that on strategy page.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And of course, the big one was the two suicide bombers in Jordan blowing up an Arab, wedding reception. And the one suicide bomber, I forget, I think she just chickened out. There was a man and a woman. Anyway, she walked out of there alive and was able to provide additional information on, you know, what the plan was, and that it was indeed, you know, Al-Qaeda trying to punish the Jordanians for supporting the Americans in fighting Al-Qaeda in Iraq, et cetera, et cetera. That was the straw that broke the camel's back, so to speak. And after that, the approval ratings nosedived, and we, again, we reported this. It became much harder to raise money, to get recruits, and that trend has just continued. And so whoever takes over from Bin Laden is taking over, you know, a very sick franchise, so to speak. And that's basically what Al-Qaeda has turned into, a franchise. Once they lost their base in Afghanistan in 2001, they were never able to put it back together. Even the bases in Pakistan are more the terrorist groups that the Pakistani government created or allowed to flourish, you know, in the 1980s to attack India. It's more them than it is, you know, Al-Qaeda. And probably one thing that's going to come out of the Bin Laden documents, if it's released anytime soon, is to what extent the Pakistani Islamic terrorist organizations and Al-Qaeda did not get along, because there have been, you know, there have been hints of that. I mean, you know, over 1,000 Al-Qaeda members have been killed in Pakistan because of violence, often with tribesmen, with pro-Taliban groups. And as far as I can tell, there have been incidents of the local Islamic terrorist groups, you know, shooting it out with Al-Qaeda over, you know, turf or, you know, authority or resources, whatever. We don't know that. Nobody knows that right now except the people who have those documents and those people within Al-Qaeda who basically contributed to those documents. But those Al-Qaeda, you know, Bin Laden documents are a unique collection of information, because no one but Bin Laden had access to them. So, I mean, basically there was one guy, unless he let, you know, one of his sons or anybody else there, you know, go through this stuff. But as we also pointed out in an item we published in the last few days, the United States has data mining and data analysis tools which will probably find, you know, meanings, as it were, information, nuggets of information inside all that data that even Bin Laden wasn't aware of. I mean, this is a big thing, and you know, in what they call the search industry, it actually incorporates business information, business intelligence, and data mining, and all this other stuff. You know, the kind of stuff that the people that Austin was working with over in Iraq. It's been a powerful tool, and we report on it as much as we can without giving the enemy any aid and comfort. Well, we don't give them any comfort at all, but fortunately there are a few people even in the West who understand some of that stuff. I mean, it's some pretty hairy math they're applying. But in that area, there's been tremendous progress in the last, you know, decade or so, and that Bin Laden set of documents is a gold mine. It's just the kind of target you want to turn those tools loose on. So I'm waiting for there to be a identifiable outcomes, like, you know, raids being made, you know, people being killed with missiles, whatever, arrests being made. There's been a few so far that it's hard to say, well, this is because of the Bin Laden documents, because this type of intelligence work has been done, you know, for the last decade, and it's become more and more used, and it's become more effective. I mean, that's how they found Bin Laden in the first place. You know, they found the needles in the haystack. And now they have, you know, a haystack which is full of gold. And let's hope they find it.
Yeah. Now, one of the questions... Go ahead, Austin.
Let me make a quick comment on that. Everybody out there, remember, I'm an operations guy. That's what I do. Ops and plans. But when Jim says... the being exposed to some of the analytic techniques, you get the refined product. A lot of some of it will be, of course, speculative, but what they're trying to do is draw connections and inferences of connections. And I mean, look, you can see this. Read a good Sir Arthur Conan Doyle short story about Sherlock Holmes on making inferences from it. But we've got all kinds of techniques that have been refined over the since 2001. That's really when we have to kickstart that system. Those components were there, but we really it kickstarted it. And as Jim, did you use the term trove? Or you know, this is the mother load coming out of Bin Laden, and because he was. He was a nexus. He was a place where a lot of the points connected, albeit in a creaky old-fashioned fashion with couriers coming to him. But this is the thing. Al-Qaeda was a damaged organization after the mass murders at the wedding in Amman, Jordan, as Jim pointed out. And you could see that the decline 2005, 2006. And as I mentioned in a column I wrote this week, even in 2008, I wrote a column about Al-Qaeda's damaged goods, and Bin Laden is a failure in many respects, and some of the larger goals that he certainly articulated in 1999, 2000, 2001. He didn't get his caliphate. He didn't buckle America. Nevertheless, he retained... I think I use the term, now I know I use the term in the column, a kind of a gangsta cult appeal, because he hadn't been caught yet and he's on the run. And he was still an inspirational figure of a type. We see he was an inspirational figure, and I'm basing this on what I've read in the online media, that he still had aspirational operations. He wanted to go after the United States, and he was somewhat connected to at least promoting the planning of the various Al-Qaeda franchises, to pick up on Jim's terminology. That's a good way of looking at it. Nevertheless, this inspirational quality. I argued in that column that now's the time to go ahead and at least finish him off as best you can, so that he's a damaged myth, he's a damaged martyr, he's not much of a martyr, and some of the material coming out of that treasure trove of intelligence, some of the videos that I've seen on the web, I'm thinking of two in particular, he looks old, he looks creaky, he looks... narcissistic, and the one sitting next to his bed watching himself on Al Jazeera and perhaps CNN, he's channel surfing. Those are the kind of things that the United States needs to be putting on the internet to show would-be terrorists who are still enthralled by Bin Laden's gangster image. Yeah, to say that this is the way he ended up. He looks like a pathetic old man. And that's another component. You ask us, where do we go from here? That's one of the things to do.
Yeah.
It's not only to act against what we act on the information that we've gleaned from the mother load and do the networking and connective techniques that Jim mentioned, but also just step out with an advertising campaign. Counter his propaganda with, take a look at where this guy is 10 years later. Global caliphate, I think Jim called it Chateau Bin Laden. Down here in Texas, we call it Casa Bin Laden. It's been the joke. You know, it's kind of a pathetic place. It's not as bad as a cave, but you know, if he'd been out in the cave, he'd still be a warrior. Here he was kind of a guy with, you know, in a big cinder block in a concrete house, huddling in a blanket. This is kind of pathetic to it. And it takes a lot of sheen off of it. He's not Che Guevara, guys. Of course, Che Guevara wasn't Che Guevara. He had a myth built around him. Here's the chance to damage Bin Laden. He ain't no Che Guevara.
Now, one of the interesting things is, and the reason there's going to be a huge amount of data, is the fact that, you know, he was camped there for 6 years. But the question comes up.
Is that confirmed now? Because there have been things that says it was 4 years, five, six. It is 6 years now.
I think they said that he was there since 2005.
Okay.
What my understanding is. Do you have something else or?
Well, that's why we want to interview the three wives he was camped out with.
Right. Yeah. Let's say at least he was there 4 years. I mean, the amount of, as we all know from our hard drives on our computers, the amount of data we collect.
Oh yeah.
That's huge. But the other question that goes with that, Jim, is how could he be in one place for so long and the Packies didn't know that he was there? How is this going to affect our relation with
Pakistanis? There's one thing that, as far as I can tell, has not come out in the Western media. Of course, the Western media tends to miss, you know, things like this. And that is that there are a lot of people who hide in plain sight in Pakistan, especially gangsters. Something that is, we talk in general about corruption in Pakistan, but one of the most corrupt things is there are some pretty powerful, what we would call mafia, you know, type gangs, and these guys pay off all the right people, and they basically have official protection. Now, all they gotta say is, well, that villa belongs to the so-and-so, you know, gang. Oh, stay away from it. Say no more. And for all we know, and hopefully somebody in our government going over those documents knows, you know, how it was, you know, protected. I'm sure they didn't say it was Bin Laden. Most likely, in fact, some reporters did talk to people who lived in that neighborhood. And they once said, for example, oh, they thought it was some rich guy who killed somebody in his village. Now, what he's saying there, this is Pushtun, you know, territory, somebody from the tribal territory who's got a blood feud going. Yes, that's a good reason to go, you know, basically hide in an expensive villa in an upscale, you know, area outside of the capital. But he's not the only one. In other words, Pakistanis don't find it unusual that there's a mysterious bunch of people living for years in a walled villa.
Well,
that's just the way things are in Pakistan.
Let me add something to the report that Jim had. The day after the SEAL raid, I believe it was the Daily Telegraph had that's where I read it on their website. A reporter drove from Islamabad to Abbottabad, which is not a long drive, and spoke to some of the people living in the neighborhood, and one man said that we thought they were drug dealers, and then he found another woman who said we thought they were a drug gang, and they were afraid of them. I had one other thing I remember from that article was that the one fellow they talked to said, you know, they just didn't come out and they didn't talk to other people, and here they are so wealthy, I never saw them give any charity. In other words, he just found this faithful Muslim
that's
man.
That's right.
And that was something going through his mind. And that's really, see, that's a kind of insight on the way many people in Pakistan are. They, as Jim describes it, there are these threats out there, but then these other people that he'd made the judgment, these were rich people who were selfish, and they might be dangerous. It's just better to stay away from them. So at the local, you know, people on the street, they knew that something was going on, but they were afraid of it.
You know, it sounds like almost the Pakistani version of when they interview people here in the United States and you know, mass murderers living next door to him. They go, oh, he was just a normal guy. But in Pakistan, they go, oh, he was just a normal drug dealer there.
Well, I can tell one story that a friend of mine who's a policeman told me a little over a year ago about to understand that the time frame on when this was discovered was 2003, 2004. Huge mansion in Travis County, Texas, on kind of a secluded road. Federal investigators, FBI, and who else, and Drug Enforcement Task Force shows up and says this house is owned by XYZ. You couldn't remember the name of the particular drug lord, and we're going to take control of it as, you know, seizing ill-gotten goods. And they said the various police agencies in the area went back, we have anything, you know, any indication? Nothing. They had no indication about, you know, the normal house. There was this huge house owned by a cartelista. So that goes on in our. You said it's the, you know, the mass murderer next door. You know, somebody's been subtle about it. The drug cartelista is investing in high upscale property, and you know, within
3 miles of your own home, and the police are unaware of it because there's nothing that got on their radar.
Right.
That's not exactly the same situation as procures in Abbottabad, but there is some similarity about the way people respond to it, and most people just want to be left alone as long as they're being left alone. So that doesn't explain a lot, but maybe it does.
So, Jim, is your feeling basically that there is not going to be somebody that steps in and fills the vacuum, not necessarily from Al-Qaeda, but another group that appears on the scene?
Well, there have been other groups which have, in effect, branded themselves as Al-Qaeda. There's the North African Islamic radicals, which were defeated in Algeria. You know, I guess by 2005, that was pretty much over. I mean, some of them are still there, and they've turned into a drug gang down in the Sahel. They're moving drugs from, Guinea-Bissau? Anyway, from cocaine being flown in to West Africa, and they're basically transporting it up to the Mediterranean coast and then getting it over to Europe. But there are still some of them out there, you know, blowing up police and army patrols and what have you. The current Al-Qaeda leadership is mostly the Egyptians. I mean, the top four or five people, the only non-Egyptian was bin Laden himself. They are basically the remnants of the radical groups who tried to take over Egypt in the 1990s and were defeated. The Muslim Brotherhood that currently exists in Egypt is basically the less lethal branch of the Islamic radical groups in Egypt. The really bad actors were either killed or driven out of the country. So there's not going to be any, there was never any real successor there. Now in Yemen, you have the Al-Qaeda that were driven out of Saudi Arabia. They always consider themselves Al-Qaeda, but they're really in no position, to grab leadership because they're basically in the gun sights. They're being hunted, daily. Not so much by the Yemeni government, which is in the midst of one of these Arab Spring, uprisings at the moment. But apparently the United States still has license to hunt and kill with the UAVs, in Yemen. And of course the airports, Anybody flying in from Yemen is carefully watched in the United States and Europe and what have you. So that's not really a suitable place. There's still Pakistan, but again, Pakistan has their own, terrorist organizations. And the Al-Qaeda groups there basically have been keeping their heads down because they have fights not only with the United States and Afghanistan, but also with the local, Pakistanis. So there really has been nobody or no real Al-Qaeda Central. All we know is that there were, the senior people were apparently still hiding out somewhere in Pakistan, and there are still some left there. But there's really not a lot to take over. Somebody probably will. And like I say, the people who know best what is likely to happen are the people going over those documents. They've released some stuff, like the home movies, which Austin suggested should be done because it's embarrassing. They want to talk to the wives because they'll undoubtedly get more embarrassing stuff that they can leak, as it were. But the really useful stuff as where other bad guys are and what they're up to, that's going to be kept secret until somebody is arrested or killed or what have you. But who exactly is going to come out on top? If the Egyptians, Al-Ahari and various others you don't hear much about, if they don't get away with it, I don't think anybody of any meaning, who is meaningful, will actually try it. Because basically it's like herding cats. You've got all these groups that never were part of Al-Qaeda that have renamed themselves Al-Qaeda because Al-Qaeda at one time meant something, but now it's simply become, a brand, like Holiday Inn. If you're own a hotel that's not doing so well, you buy a Holiday Inn franchise, rebrand yourself, and see if that makes you do any better. I suspect we might find people dropping the Al-Qaeda branding because it's basically become a polluted brand. It doesn't simply have the cachet, and some people have said that with bin Laden gone, you know, who's left? There's nobody that has a, you know, as they say in the marketing business, a Q score, you know, that's recognizable, that's famous for being famous. So this, indeed, with the demise of Bin Laden, this might be the beginning of the end of Al-Qaeda as a brand, you know, because that's all it was after 2001.
And the other radical Islamic groups, their concerns are more regional, such as the Indonesians, the groups in Thailand, the groups in the Philippines who have the...
Well, they're not only regional, but they're pure survival.
Right.
Because all those regional groups are under tremendous pressure. The ones in Indonesia, basically wiped out. The ones in the Philippines, Abu Sayyaf and what have you, they're being chased around the island by a bunch of Philippine Marines, which, believe me, is not pleasant. It doesn't sound pleasant. It is not pleasant. You know, they're basically trying to catch the fanatic remnants, and month by month, they grab another one. In Thailand, it's not going well for the Islamic radicals in the south. It's not going well for them anywhere. I mean, Yemen, they make a lot of noise, but most of the noise in Yemen is about the usual tribal animosities towards whoever is trying to pass themselves off as the central government. Same thing with the Taliban in Afghanistan. The problem with Islamic radicalism is that it's always been decentralized. There was a momentary unity under the Al-Qaeda, you know, brand, as it were, and that went away in the last decade. So we're now back to all these groups, but what they have that they didn't have before is the Internet. We can blame it on the Internet. We say all these positive things about Twitter and the Internet in general, but one of the really negative things is, and this is admitted by people, you know, without realizing who praising the Internet, it allows a lot of very fringe groups that were always out there but didn't, weren't connected with each other, now they get connected. And a lot of the people have died in the last decade because the Islamic maniacs, terrorists, people who want to kill, are now connected. And they can be more dangerous that way. The only good thing about this is the intelligence agencies have learned how to mine the, you know, the Internet for clues and suspects and what have you. So it's not a free ride for the bad guys, but it does allow them to get together. And a lot of them have gone from just, you know, mouthing off, you know, trolling pro-terrorist, you know, message boards and what have you, to sneaking off into a darker offline corner and actually trying to kill people. And we've seen a number of examples of that in the United States. A lot of the guys that have been caught, nobody's done a lot of killing, but some of them have, like Major, was it Nasir, down in Texas. They basically, you know, got their encouragement and in some cases their start, you know, through the Internet. And then they proceeded, you know, to kill people. But there's been no mass attacks. But the activity is still out there, and it's all because of the Internet. It doesn't need what Al-Qaeda stood for. Al-Qaeda basically was an old style, pre-Internet type organization. And it's basically been replaced by all these little nodules of wackos, you know, out on the Internet. They keep encouraging one another, and it's, you know, it's the law of averages. Occasionally you're going to find one who's going to go out and try and do something.
Yeah, so...
Let me make a couple of quick points here.
Okay. We're
coming up on time. One, Jamaa Islamiyah, which was the Al-Qaeda franchise in Southeast Asia, was really hurt when Hambali was taken, and he was arrested in Thailand, as I recall. Wasn't that late 2003?
Yeah.
I'm doing this off the top of my head. So you pinched their top planner and really their local regional Bin Laden. That really did hurt him. Secondly, we really didn't get put the part of your question about did somebody in Pakistan know. I stick my neck out on this. And I think somebody in the Inner Services Intelligence Directorate, ISI, running the Islamic extremist organizations probably knew. I think that's my hunch is that, yeah, somebody within ISI did who's was a pro-Islamic extremist. So, but that's, you know, that's not they're fighting a slow civil war in Pakistan among modernizers and the extremists, and that civil war is being fought within ISI. I'd be interested before we wrap up in hearing what Jim thinks about that.
Well, ISI is a combined a combination of again we've reported on this in
we've written about that for years, man. I know that.
It was an evolution of Pakistani intelligence operations when the government found out the intelligence organizations who were spending more time fighting each other than they were, you know, doing the job of, collecting intelligence the government could use. So they basically combined them all, and that's what ISI is. So they're basically, like in Britain, you have MI5 for, domestic intelligence and MI6 for overseas. ISI, combines it all. The problem with putting all your eggs in one basket is what if the eggs all go bad? And that's what happened. Now, ISI still handles internal intelligence, which has been a bone of contention because it's used by the government in power to persecute, real or potential opponents. But its mandate is to know what is going on out there. And one of the things it keeps tabs on, as Austin was saying, was the Islamic terrorist groups, some of whom, were founded or, nurtured by ISI. I'm sure they have, I would imagine that they have a desk that specializes in, large compounds that contain unidentified people. Because a lot of the time that's either going to be gangsters, drug gangs, whatever, that you're supposed to keep track of as part of internal intelligence, if only to shake them down. Rogue Islamic terror groups, which they have to be careful of because some of these have declared war on the Pakistani government and made serious attempts on killing, sometimes successfully, senior officials in the government. So ISI, if only in self-defense, has to, watch out for these guys. So, Austin's point is well taken. There was probably some guy, maybe nobody was listening to him, but he says, this place down in, Abbottabad, I think that's some big, Al-Qaeda guy that we haven't been able to locate. Then again, it may come out that, they were, basically providing cover all along. Again, the only people who know are the people going through this treasure trove of information, because obviously a lot of the answers are going to be there either explicitly or implicitly, just putting together all the pieces. Aha! Here are the list of contacts in the ISI that Al-Qaeda was using. Well, that could be interesting.
Yeah. Well, it looks like what's going to happen in the future is that we're going to see a lot of single actors and not the large, well-laid-out plans like we saw on 9/11.
Yes, and one thing that has been leaked was that an initial surprise in the Bin Laden documents was that he was still involved in trying to get, plots and schemes going. But obviously he had communications problems. He had to work via couriers. But he was still putting it out there and he was still releasing those audio, tapes, and a very much diminishing number of video, releases, to encourage the troops. But they just didn't have the resources anymore. They had no training camps. They had competitors who were sometimes hostile. When they find out it was one of the Pakistani terror groups that provided the information that helped, confirm that, Bin Laden was there. Because obviously you're sticking your neck out, when you're sending in the SEALs into a foreign country, even though there were, nod and wink type deals made in the past that, hey, yeah, if you find Bin Laden, you can do it. The fact of the matter is that the biggest problem with Al-Qaeda is not the organization, but the ideas.
Right.
And because of the internet, they're all out there.
Right. Well, that's a good place to wrap it up, gentlemen, and we'll talk to you next time.
Bye, Dan.